This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week is part one of our comedy and mental health mini-series. Each week till the end of August, we'll be releasing an episode where we interview a different comedian who's performing here at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. Up first, we've got Scott Gibson, who's a comic from Glasgow, and I wanted to read his description from his website because I think it's hilarious. The big, bold, bearded Glaswegian, a naturally skillful and riveting raconteur, mixes a conversational style with his own unique brand of dark humour, glorious bad language and shrewd observations.
I love that. I just had this like amazing image of him in my head, even though I know what he looks like. It's just this big bearded guy, this big strong Scottish bearded comedian with a big smile on his face.
Yeah, he is a lot of fun, and it was really great to get to interview him. And this year his show is actually themed around mental health, which is quite different to when I've seen him perform in the past, in that that's been, well, he's a storytelling comedian, so in the past when I've seen him, it's been really lighthearted. You know, it's interesting, like, departure from, like, that kind of content to now having a show themed around mental health. So it kind of switches between, like, very, like, funny and jovial and banter with the audience to then quite serious segments where he talks about diagnosis and stigma and things that he feels held him back, like potentially being a big, bold guy from Glasgow, and also some factors around his family life as well. So it was really interesting to kind of get to know a different side of him. And then in the interview, we obviously got a lot deeper into where a lot of that humour comes from and some of the deeper stories behind the humour that he puts through in this show.
In the show, Bobby, did he still, you know, use the serious comments but in a jokey way?
I think he's quite a naturally funny person in how he comes across. Like, he is quite loud, he's quite sweary, like, he has good banter. And so I think by leaning into that, it really helped lighten the tone. But he did say near the start of the show that not all of the audiences had got that it was okay to laugh throughout. So he kind of started off with that disclaimer that this is meant to be funny. So there are some bits that are a bit dark, but feel free to laugh.
Right.
And I thought that was good of, like, kind of setting the tone, because you know what? If nothing else, laughter relaxes people. If there is a bit that's a bit tough going and then he cracks a joke in the middle, well, it's quite reassuring for the audience. And that's something we'll be touching on a few times through this mini-series of how comedy and mental health intersect, how one can really support the other and help you kind of figure out, by being a comedian, figure out some of the experiences you've been through by, like, rehashing them through humour, but also in doing so, learning to see the funny side of even the toughest things you've been through. And I think that can be really powerful for the audience as well. There can be something quite safe about hearing any kind of storytelling told in a comic way. It seems quite disarming, and that certainly applies to mental health as well. So yeah, so we'll get into all of that a bit more in the episode. For now, we've got a few stats to kind of set the scene for this topic. So first off, from CNN Health, they reported, it's unclear just how many comedians struggle with mental challenges such as depression, but many of the most familiar names have talked and joked about the issue, including Robin Williams, Sarah Silverman, Stephen Fry, Spike Jonze, Woody Allen, and Ellen DeGeneres. It's no accident that the Laugh Factory in Hollywood even has its own in-house psychologist. The Laugh Factory being quite a notable comedy venue.
Well, I thought that was so interesting, you know, going through the research, that the Laugh Factory have actually got, you know, a setup to support the mental health of the comedians. I mean, that kind of says it all. But in general, there's so many ways to look at this, because, you know, some of the research talks about people already have certain traits in their character that aren't dissimilar from people that struggle with mental illness, and that could be why they fall into comedy? Or is it that comedians talk about things that we all just struggle with, and because they're comedians, they can do it? They can. And obviously there are comedians out there that literally anything goes. And, you know, obviously there's some really famous comedians and comic actors that we know of that have really struggled with their mental health. You know, people like Robin Williams, sadly, you know, where things have led to tragic circumstances. So it's a real serious thing. But the comedy aspect is just so interesting in terms of their ability to talk about it and in an open way, and for people to be able to laugh about things.
I think there's such power in that, in speaking about it on stage and being able to make light of it, you know, not only for the comedian, but also for the audience. It's incredibly normalizing that comedy should be an art form where anything can be talked about, any topic, when tackled appropriately, can be talked about. And, you know, that is so important. And it's really great to see that that's happening with mental health, because historically it's maybe been mentioned here and there, but I think a lot of comedians, particularly being at the Fringe Festival this year, I'm noticing a real shift where it's not just like a random throwaway or like self-deprecating joke about mental health. It's going a bit deeper than that. You know, it's talking about their real life experiences, and that can get a bit deep, but I think it's really powerful. It's them owning their truth and normalizing experiences of mental illness, which are normal because they're common, because so many people go through them.
Yeah.
And yet so often we don't see that replicated in the shows that we go and see.
Absolutely.
So the next thing I wanted to mention is from the Huffington Post. A lot of this came back to the core scientific link, in that laughter in particular releases endorphins, which make us feel happy, as well as other hormones which are linked to reduced stress and boosting our immune system. They also found links in terms of strengthening social relationships. And then specifically when it comes to mental health, the release of these happy hormones are an excellent short-term relief for symptoms of mental illness we may be experiencing, whilst a heightened level of social bonding can lead to longer-term feelings of inclusion and the creation of support networks. Both are key elements in the fight against depression.
Mm.
So I found that good in terms of the kind of general link, both scientifically, but also the social aspects of laughter as a group activity, going to shows or watching a comedy special with friends or family. They've even mentioned a scientific field called gelotology, which is the study of laughter, which isn't something I even realised existed.
I know. I thought it was great. And I think that both of those, I think the fact that we're speaking about it from a comedian point of view in terms of their own mental health, but actually the benefits for the audience and those watching. I remember once, and it really hit me. I was like, I left home and I was having quite a low time. And I left home one day for work just feeling really shit and really low. And it was just awful. And something came on the radio and it made me laugh. And I laughed out loud in the car driving to work. This is a couple of years ago, and just changed my whole vibe. Mm-hmm. And like, I went to work, and it wasn't at the time. It was only when I was reflecting, and I thought, just because something came on the radio that absolutely cracked me up, just changed my whole day, my whole vibe. And I would have sworn to anybody in that moment of that, in that low moment, that I was really, really struggling, and it was all, nothing was worth it, and the whole day was just, my whole life was just blah 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 blah. Now, don't get me wrong, it depends of your levels of mental illness, depends how you are day to day and how bad things are. But absolutely, it is a remedy.
Mm-hmm.
Laughing is a remedy. There's no doubt about it. And as you said, going to shows with friends and, you know, I mean, I can imagine it's a bit awkward, though, if you're like the mate that suffers and your mates aren't like great at supporting you, and like you stumble into a show thinking it's going to be all laughs, and the comedian starts talking about his mental health and you're just not in a great place, you'd be like, oh my god, it's like the pink elephant in a room, this is me. But I can imagine it just like alleviates all that awkwardness, and your friends and everybody just brings it into life in just a completely different way. I love it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's so important in terms of reaching those people that may not otherwise be around conversations about mental health. Yep. And that may not even realise that there can be a funny side of it. I think there's a certain dark humour that can come with experiencing mental illness, where you kind of sometimes things are so bad and make so little sense, all you can do is laugh at them, you know, because sometimes it is funny how randomly some of these symptoms can interact and crop up.
My auntie, who is on medication, and she won't mind me saying this, she's quite high functioning. Well, not that often, but she can be. And when she is, we absolutely howl about the times when she's not, because it is hilarious. Some of her behaviour is absolutely hilarious. And we all sit there thinking, what the hell have we just witnessed? And we can laugh about it when she's well. We really can, because you're right. Some isolated incidences are really funny, the way that we might behave or things we might randomly say.
Yeah, and there was even a mention of something like that from the Huffington Post UK blog, where they interviewed someone called Jo Blewett, who's a laughter consultant, which I think sounds like an incredibly fun job. And he said, laughter has a way of instantly connecting people and is one of the most basic and fundamental ways in which we communicate as human beings. But more than that, laughter can increase confidence, self-esteem, creativity, positivity, and resilience, bringing positive changes to all aspects of our lives.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah, no, I thought that was really good. And also on what I mentioned about the importance of reaching different demographics of people, there's a researcher called John Ryan who has published papers on the effectiveness of comedy in mental health. And to him, the standout finding was that it's most important as part of the comedy industry in that it can reach people who wouldn't normally be exposed to discussions around mental well-being. So those people that may not talk about it openly yet, being in a situation like a comedy show, there's something disarming about that. You can get away with talking about things that are often seen as taboo or stigmatized.
Absolutely. And I think that's the same in terms of even general subjects that comedians bring up. Some of those subjects and some of those life experiences that can actually lead to mental illness, because they're spoken about and everybody's laughing, meaning generally when everyone's laughing at a comedian, it's because they're all engaged, they're all connected with what the comedian's saying. Like, we're all like, oh my God, that is just so me. Like, we deal with that. You know, so many times I watch comedy things and I'm like, could be sat watching it with your partner or with your parent, and they talk about something that's so relative to your family situation or your partner or being a mum or whatever it might be. And everybody else is laughing because everybody else feels the same. Even that, as you said, the word disarming, you can look around and think, oh my God, I thought that was just us. I thought that was just my man. Or I thought that was just my mum or my child. That I'm the only mum who feels hysterical at times or who feels like she can't cope with being a mum. No, I'm not, because all these women in this audience are absolutely cracking up as well because they feel the same. Right. So even in that, it can kind of really bring to life the fact that, as you said earlier, the commonality of so many issues that we all face that actually do sometimes lead to low self-esteem, early onset depression, you know, all of the things that we're talking about with regard to mental health.
For sure. And it's a really open and non-judgmental way to start these conversations. You know, yeah. If you can start talking about mental health or any other sensitive topic via a joke, you know, not an offensive joke, there are bad ways to go about this, but you know, if you can come at it from humor, it's a nice, like, less direct way of getting into those conversations. And that's why particularly it's so inspiring to see the comics I'm getting to interview while I'm up here are bringing elements of like mental health storytelling and their personal experience into the shows in the hope that it does help reduce that stigma. And it helps start conversations for people. And that's very much what we try and do here. So I'm definitely on board with that. And Scott Gibson, I think, is a wonderful comedian to start with. I've seen him perform, I think, 2 or 3 times now. And yeah, he's really funny. I'm a bit of a sucker for a Glasgow accent. I just think it makes everything sound funnier, to be honest. And so we'll get into the episode with Scott shortly. And then for the next 2 weeks, we've got 2 other brilliant comedians talking all things comedy and mental health. One thing to mention with today's episode, there is mentions of suicide and self-harm throughout, so just bear that in mind when it comes to this episode. So we'll get into that in just a moment, but first... Who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
I am Scott Gibson, a comic based in Edinburgh now. I finally went to get help, if you want to call it, or started to seek help in about 2017. And after, maybe 6 months after that, when I had actually spoken to a therapist for the first time, I actually started to realise my mental health, or my journey with depression, if you want to call that, had actually started far sooner, just not realising that the state I was in was a state of depression. I don't know if it's something to do with being, guys, we, you know, the west of Scotland, there is this kind of hard shell, if you like, of mental health. And I certainly think now that we say that it's easy to talk about mental health, I think that is true in some cases. But I think there are maybe elements of whether it's society, whether you're standing in society or your position in the map, of how easy that is to speak about it. I certainly found it very difficult to talk about it. I could, strangely enough, talk about it in a general sense. I found it very difficult to talk about my own struggle with it. And oddly, doing comedy, I actually thought for a long time that that's the reason why I was able to be a comic, was because I had dark thoughts or difficult times in my life. Some strange way that was like your power and able to do what you do, whereas normal people can function and go and do a job.
Mm-hmm.
Stuck in an office for 8 hours, and I thought, well, the reason why I'm able to tell stories or be a comic is because I have this dark side to me. And that's obviously a lot of bollocks, you know, but it's not until you actually speak to someone that you realise that. But I had struggled for a long time, and there'd never been an occasion when I was young that, you know, you couldn't talk to, like, family or parents, but there is a sense of you just have to get on with it. There is a real sense that, in a weird way, the word depression's been diluted in how frequently people talk about it, because unless you have depression or something, you've no idea. You know, I had said in the past, you know, I feel depressed, but until you realise you've got depression, it's not like you know, the flu, or you're just feeling run down. And I think people band it about now more easily, going, oh, I'm feeling depressed, or I think I'm depressed. Like, you've real no idea what true depression is. But yeah, until I went and got help, I hadn't really realised that for a long time the things I had been feeling were actually the cause of my depression. I had a period for about a week where I was suicidal. I've had suicidal thoughts, and that's what pushed me to go and get help, because it really scared me. I had suicidal thoughts twice, like two distinct periods, 2017 and towards the end of 2018. The second time when I had come off medication, because I had stupidly been 6 months feeling great and thinking, oh, I'm cured, you know, as if it's something that you can cure in that way. Came off medication and then fell even further than I had before. Neither of those occasions of having suicidal thoughts did I ever feel as though I wanted to kill myself. I felt as though I was being shown this is going to happen kind of thing. So it was a very strange feeling to have. Almost as if I wasn't in control of my own thoughts. That's the only way I could describe it to the doctor at the time. I remember saying to her, I am aware that I don't want to kill myself. I just maybe don't want to be here or be in, you know, feeling the things I'm feeling. But I'm having these dreams that's almost showing me that something's going to happen.
Yeah, and I just want to pause on that, because that's a really good point about that distinction. For so many people, suicidal thoughts are more so about them being unable to continue with what they're going through now, as opposed to them thinking, oh, death, wouldn't that be wonderful?
Yeah.
And that is a common misconception that really persists.
There's people who, I've heard people talk about suicide in the past, like a coward's way out, you know, or as if it's like it's the easy option. And I also, something that I try and talk about in the show was that I felt very embarrassed about feeling that way, because although now, like 2019, there's a lot of discussion around structure of gender and what a man's role is, a woman's role, and the lines between that, and rightly so, that discussion is happening. And I think the old ideas of a man and a woman, not they no longer exist, but they are becoming more transparent. But there's still an element of whether it is geographic of where I come from in Scotland or your upbringing, there's still an idea of, you know, you're a man, you're a strong man. So to admit that you have a problem almost was me admitting that I was weak. That's what it felt like. That's why it took me such a long time. I mean, it took about 3 months before I actually went to a doctor. And I, you know, and then I just broke down. I couldn't, I had a speech prepared, everything I was going to say and stuff I wanted to talk about, because I was conscious that I felt as if I go to the doctor and do this, I may not come back if I don't get it all out. So I wanted to just tell them exactly what I'd been thinking, exactly what had happened, and get it all out. And even then, I felt as if I was admitting that I was weak in some way. And again, that couldn't have been further from the truth as well.
And so at that point, you felt so bad in the suicidal thoughts that you kind of felt that was your last chance in a way to get this across,
totally,
and get the help.
Yeah. I went in and spoke to my GP. And again, stupidly, I had convinced myself that I, you know, not everyone in life is happy. Social media has always been a big thing for me, impacting my mental health. And I'd convinced myself that, you know, not everybody in life can be happy. So I'm just one of those people that will never find happiness or never be happy. And again, that's a lot of shit as well. So even when you meet someone who has depression or someone talks to you about it, you just think, you've no idea what I'm going to, like, you just don't want to believe, or you're not willing to accept that someone can feel the way you're feeling. There's almost a comfort in that loneliness that you just want to disappear again and go, right, well, this is me. No one knows what I'm going through. I'll just be myself. I'll be alone. But when I spoke to the doctor, I was also worried that if I took a tablet that I would lose whatever spark I had to do comedy, as stupid as that sounds. And obviously they, you know, told me that wouldn't be the case, kind of thing. But to be fair to them, when I went in, I just told her what was happening. I broke down. She was very kind, took a lot of time, longer than what I thought we were going to have. And we just sat and spoke, and then I started to take medication at that time. And yeah, since then, the other concern you have is when you come back, when you first take that tablet, you know, it's almost like a hope. And stupidly you think, right, if I take one, you know, within an hour, I'll be, you know, out for a jog, or I'll be, you know, feeling happy and joyful again. You're like, no, it takes time. But there is almost a bit of, you know, like, I don't know, like you just suddenly see a bit of light. You know, you just suddenly think, right, all I need to do is start taking these tablets and trust that this will help. And that will do so much, but you have to look at the other things in your life that are impacting on that, because I don't think you just become depressed overnight. It's a gradual thing.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't think it's ever just one cause either.
No, not at all. And also, from talking to someone after it, you don't just have, you very rarely tend to just have one mental health issue. It'll normally go hand in hand with something else. So I started to become very anxious. I'd never been an anxious person before, but suddenly certain situations, my anxiety would go through the roof. And on a couple of occasions, go to the point where having a panic attack. Now, I had never in my life ever been anxious in a situation or ever had a panic attack, to the point where if I knew someone who, you know, would say to me, I'm feeling quite anxious, you'd be like, what's just, you know, toughen up, man, what's wrong with you? But when you have those things, it's horrible, man. Like, it feels, you know, it feels like your world is closing in on you. It's a horrible thing. But now that I am aware of it, and also I'm lucky that I have a partner she's come through something similar in her life, so she can, you know, see that in me if I'm being anxious. Or there's also certain situations where you don't put yourself in it. You just have to learn what your triggers are, what can set off either your depression or your anxiety. I'm in an industry that is so false in what it puts out to the world, where I've had friends who, you know, I will take the time, you speak to them on the phone, and they're concerned about a situation with work, or they're concerned about a gig or an agent or something, and then they will tweet or, you know, Facebook or Instagram the exact opposite of what you've just been discussing, because as long as the false image that goes out, you know, as long as the brand remains strong, everything's fine. You're like, this is not on, man.
And I think there is so much pressure in that whenever you're not just in a performance industry, but when you're a comic, it's just you. Uh-huh. You know, so as much as you can have an agent and a venue and support behind you, mm-hmm. people's relationship is ultimately with you.
Yeah, totally. No.
And it's like what you mentioned earlier about how lonely and isolating depression can be, mm-hmm. because you're feeling a way that you don't see reflected in the world.
No.
You've got all this going on internally, and then all these people are acting like everything's okay.
Yeah, totally.
And it can be so alienating. But then in comedy, that's even more amplified,
mm-hmm.
because those same people that may also be sharing similar symptoms are still getting up on stage and still doing a good set.
Yeah.
And you're like, what's going on there?
I mean, I thought I was almost schizophrenic at one point, where I would literally not leave the house unless I had a gig.
Mm.
Sometimes I wouldn't, if I didn't have a gig, I wouldn't shower, I wouldn't do anything, you know, because I thought there's no point, man. And I would go to work and not realising it. I was in a very difficult relationship that was a very bad situation to be in, and it took me a long time to get out of that relationship. But looking back, I'm realising that comedy was the escape, you know, and it just so happened to be that my work as a comic, that just happens to be what my work was. If I had been in an office or, you know, whatever, a factory, that would have been my escape from what was pushing the difficult situation that I felt trapped in.
Mm-hmm.
But I did. I mean, I remember speaking to like a therapist and saying that I feel like I'm two people, you know, like I feel like when I go to work, I don't understand how I can feel the way I feel and then flick a switch and do a show for 90 minutes and then come off again and dread going home.
Mm.
But it was just over time speaking and realising that, you know, I was trying to escape a situation that I felt as though I couldn't get away from at the time. And although you can still function, mental health is just one of those things where mental health would be so much easier if it was a visible illness. Like if your skin changed a certain colour, mm-hmm. or, you know, you suddenly, I don't know, your earlobe lit up, right? And you go, oh, they've got a mental health. Do you mean? But it's the fact that no one can see it. And you can also function within it, which is even oddly affects your depression even more, because you then start to question yourself.
Right. Yeah.
You'll have days when you do feel good and you think, well, there's nothing wrong with me. You know, and then 2 days later, even the next day, even later on in that day, you will crash and you'll find yourself back in bed asleep and you can't figure out why this has happened to you.
Yeah, and that's one of the crazy things about depression. You're leaving use the good days to beat yourself up with.
Exactly.
Everything can be turned into a negative.
Or family members who don't, you know, who are not willing to... Like, I joke in the show about in Scotland, you get mental health deniers. Like, the people who just don't want to accept that it exists.
Mm.
Or the idea that, look, everyone's depressed, you just need to go on with it. You know, strangely, to an extent, when I was talking to my manager about the show, right, about what I was thinking of writing... I mean, I love her a bit, but her response to it was, no one cares, you're depressed. And to an extent, that is true. Everyone has their own problems in life. And I think one of the things with mental health that I believe, and again, I could be completely wrong and I'm not offering answers, but I think you have to get to a point where you need to realise you're responsible for your own mental health and you have to help yourself. And by that, I mean... Again, talking in my own experience, interaction with certain people or people who are a negative impact in my life, I realised I have to remove them from my life. Otherwise, even no matter how much help I get through therapy or medication, I will always have this negative force trying to draw me back in.
Yeah.
And we've all done it where, you know, it sounds so petty to think that we're grown adults that you would think to message someone to go... you've unfollowed me, and you're like, fuck off, man. Like, just the fact that people need this, you know, reassurance that there's a false friendship there or there's something there in order to feed their own. For me, that was the other side of the coin, what I'd been doing before, where I'd just been distancing myself away from things and ignoring stuff.
One thing I wanted to ask you just before you continue on that, when you were on about comedy really being a thing that kept you going,
mm-hmm.
and that becoming such a priority that it was defining whether or not you washed and left the house, etc. Mm-hmm. Did you find that affected your anxiety around performing, that if that was the thing that was the centre to your life now, what if that went away?
Yeah, no, strangely, that never... I think I was lucky that because I tell stories, or I write on stage as well, I'm not one of these comics that sits and writes at home or goes to a coffee shop and that, so I will just have an idea and then I'll go on stage and I'll just talk about that idea for like half an hour, whatever, and try and pad it out. So the turnover of material was still there. I was still able to function. The quality of the output possibly wasn't as good as previous shows had been. Certainly when I came to Edinburgh, my 2017 show had already been written by the time I came in 2016, so I had that show in the bag. And my 2018 show was an idea I'd been working on for before I'd been diagnosed, so I felt as if the bones of it were there. So I never struggled to put together like a body of work. But, and oddly, like some people think that you get, I mean, I very rarely get heckled, you know, so that never, and when you're on stage, we've had people in a show that I'm doing this year where we bring them on at the end for a quiz, and the first thing they always say is, oh, you can't see anyone. You're like, no, you can't see, when the lights are on, other than the legs of the front row, you will very rarely see a face. So there's something quite safe about being on a stage, and especially if you're touring, and because I do long form stories, the tours will be maybe 50 minutes, a break, then an hour 10. So it's a long time you're on stage. And in an odd way, it can be therapeutic just to talk and to know that people are listening and they're not going to ask you questions. It's not like this, it's not a conversation. I can talk, I can tell stories, I can be deep, I can be truthful, I can be dark. They don't know whether it's true or not.
Yeah, and I imagine there's something in that. It can feel like things are more worked out because you're presenting finished thoughts that you've worked on. And so there's something kind of finite about that, whereas the rest of your life, it's never that simple.
No.
You know, there's a reality behind every joke that's far more complex.
Yeah. You know, in that time that you're on stage, you know, after this time, we're done. And within those periods that you're on stage, you know the flow, you know the structure. Something happens in the room, you react to it, but it's never as bad as, you know, when you're off. But then when I was at the kind of, you know, the top of my depression, if you like, I mean, literally it would be as soon as you would come off, it would be back to, you know, be back to reality again.
Wow. And when you feel that, like, physically, your mood just dropping?
Completely drained. And then it would be back in the car, it would be driving to a hotel or driving home, and it would just be back to square one again. A bit like I said previously, you then maybe would have days within that where, you know, your mood would be lifted or you suddenly felt better. And that's, again, when you start to question yourself as well. When you start to question, am I depressed or am I just having a difficult time? But there comes a point where you just have to think, no. My biggest thing was I used to be so angry. Like my anger would, it was horrible, you know. It was really, and I'm quite a big man, so, you know, when I go off, it's not nice. You know, I smashed the house up once, and when I mentioned it in the show now, when I think back to the person that, I mean, I don't recognise that person anymore. I actually said to my girlfriend now, who has, I wouldn't be wrong in saying she saved my life. You know, because wrongly, if you're in a real bad relationship, there's part of you starts to believe this is what a relationship is. My friend Harriet, who I'm doing a show with, she had said that resonated with me was that when she was in a relationship, she thought, oh, you just look forward to your partner going away. That's just what a relationship is. And I'm like, well, that's what I had thought as well, but that's not. That's why you would take gigs for, like, you know, you want to come to catering for 50 quid? Yes, I will. Just to be out of the house for a certain length of time.
Yeah, you know? So true. And that's something that I think a lot of people don't get when they come out of a relationship, that you've created a culture within that relationship. In doing so, you've created really a whole new reality.
Yeah.
And then if you get into a new relationship too quickly, you're going to be forcing a whole other segment of your life onto that.
Yeah. it's quite a horrible thing to realise in yourself when you think, you know, I haven't punched like a wall or a cabinet in, you know, over a year. Mm. And you think, God, that's a pretty horrible thing.
Yeah, when that's an achievement thought, for you.
Yeah, that you've went, you know, I've went an X amount of time without violently punching something or smashing up a bit of furniture. And you think, what on earth allowed you to get to that point where that was just, like, I mean, screaming at each other was just part of day-to-day life. Not day-to-day, that's maybe going a bit far, but being able to push yourself
it's kind
to
of
that
stopped
point.
Becoming abnormal for you.
Yeah. It's just elements of your mind and how it affects it. You just think, right, well, I'm just an angry person. You know, I'm just an angry... Because I am quite angry on stage. I will rant and I will shout. And it's... again, you try and look for things within the... whether you want to call them negative traits of your personality that you think, oh, well, that's why that happens. You know, right? I'm quite shouty on stage. I rant sometimes. Well, that comes from the anger that I know I can turn on if I need it. And you go, no, what this is a performance. It's a heightened view of your personality. It's an element of truth in it because you're a storyteller. But that anger comes from somewhere else. That comes from not addressing the situation you're in or your depression is feeding into that and you maybe feel as if you don't have a voice or you don't know how to get a point across or you're not valued. So then that builds and builds and you break out of that.
And you can tell even from as an audience perspective,
mm-hmm.
when you're going off on one on stage, you know that that's controlled. You may not always know how real those emotions might be.
Yeah.
You might see it and think, oh no, he's really mad.
Yeah.
But you're also not going to leave. You're not in any danger because you know it's performative.
Yeah.
But one thing you've reminded me of that I wanted to run by you is I kind of have this theory on men and anger relating to mental health in that, yes, we are less likely to talk about mental health, but I think in some very narrow ways, we do a lot of talking about physical health.
Mm-hmm.
Like the most bro-y guys are the ones that are talking about the gym all day long.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe that's part of where this outlet for anger goes. That
mm-hmm.
as men, we're allowed in society to be happy or to be angry.
Mm-hmm.
They're the emotions we're allowed. And so when you're feeling your worst, well, that's where that goes.
Yeah. If you were to walk down any street in any city and you saw two men laughing, you would just assume two guys with a good sense of humour.
Mm.
What's the joke? If you walk down the same street and there's two men fighting, I mean, kicking the shit out of each other, you would just think... typical men, right? They're drunk, they're fighting. You see two men crying, you think, what the hell is going on?
Mm.
There's a panic in you. You're probably less likely to go up to the guys who are crying and that kind of thing, because it's just an emotion that you don't see displayed all the time. We default into that. That was my two defaults, laughing and joking, because I have used my humour as a defence since I was a child. Or violent anger, never violent towards another person. There was always that, and I don't know if it's your upbringing or if it's your, you know, again, Western Scotland, you don't hit women, that's part of it. I mean, it's mm-hmm. like, you know, that's one of the worst things, you know, anyone would ever do. You just don't, it just doesn't happen. So
I love that a siren came in as soon as we talked about hitting women.
I'm just
searching for you now.
So it was never violent, like either my ex-partner or like, you know, never a gig or something like that, or, you know, because sometimes people come to you after a gig and you just think, fuck off, man. But never violent to someone, just more like, I suppose if you had to look at it more in a kind of, as a therapist would, like, it's probably more trying to vocalise the what you're feeling. Because at the time I felt as though, you know, I couldn't get over my point of view, or I wasn't being valued. I wasn't valued as a person. So the easiest way to lash out when you're a, you know, a big guy is just to break things and make noise. But the alarming thing, like I say, was how frequent that would become. I mean, it would be at least once a week. It would, you know, be a shouting ball match. But now there's that side of me doesn't exist anymore. And that's why I have found the show difficult, in a sense of you're trying to remember certain elements of that time when I generally do not recognise that person anymore. I do regret that I allowed it to go as long as I did before getting the help, because I realise now, since being on and off medication, that I should have been on medication a long time ago. I think one of the things with mental health is that because I have read a little bit about it or looked at it a bit more because I suffer from it, there's so much that it encompasses, and it's too much. I think it's too much. I think that may be the next thing that we need to look at, that may be stopping. And I just say normal guys. I just mean like, just, you know, a bloke, just a guy who maybe doesn't have that, like that family structure's not there where you can approach your mother or father and talk about mental health. It's just something you don't talk, you just go on with it. So I don't know if we need to look at all the different elements of it and we call it something else so that people can recognise more freely, well, I've actually got, that resonates, that I might have a mental health issue.
Yeah, so I think the thinking will probably reach a point ultimately where mental illness is just thought of more as an extreme emotional reaction.
Mm-hmm.
That if things are bad enough, this happens, that's just how humans work, it's all perfectly normal.
Yeah.
And not so much whilst there'll still be illnesses at the end of the day. It's not like you catch an illness.
Yeah.
It's an illness that's a reaction to your circumstances.
Yeah, and I think circumstance is the big thing. I mean, I generally believe that in 30 years' time, there will be people in lecture theatres trying to explain to students how we allowed social media to get to the point. I really believe it. I think that you love Zuckerberg and the rest of it for war crimes, man. I think the way that social media is controlling lives even today, my partner saw something on Twitter about another comic. She was telling me about it, and I was looking at some of the comics. I'm going, it's just vile. It's just hatred. The lies that people can spread now, because they almost don't see people. They don't see you as a person anymore. They can go and be keyboard warriors and knowing 0.5% of the real facts can go on and just spread lies and bile and hate, not thinking at all about how it may impact on someone's mental health. And these will be the same people who will say, you know, I'm an advocate of mental health and I think that people need to get help. And you're thinking, the world has just become such a small place where we can interact with anyone. It feels as if no one really takes anything serious, any consequences seriously. This may be something of no interest or a side bit, but my missus loves Love Island, right?
Oh, yeah. I'm not a fan.
Well, I have never watched it, and this year I started to watch it. I was shocked at how quickly it gripped me, right? And I saw it as like this real insight into how people from what I was looking at, and I thought, these are people who have mental health is unstable, and they have handed themselves over to what is the hands of a producer, of how it is edited and put out. And I found myself watching it because she told me that I think there had been two contestants in the past who'd taken their own lives.
That's right.
From being in the show.
There's been many more talking about being suicidal.
And I found it absolutely fascinating to have heard that and then watch some of the content that had been put out. And I remember saying it on a few occasions going, this is dangerous. If they are aware that what they have built, or this false economy where they're making you a star, and yet they don't realise, because no one wants to truly believe that what you're being told isn't real. You know, that you are this star, you are this one. You have that for 6 months, and then the next series is announced and suddenly you're gone, and they can't cope with that. And I just remember watching it going, someone needs to make sure they are all right when they come out.
Mm. And the worst thing was, I wasn't even surprised. I'm on record on this very podcast saying this show is going to get worse and worse, exploit people more and more, and then someone's going to commit suicide and they'll have to cut the show. And two people did, and the show's still going.
The value of life? I mean, there's no value on it now. There's no value.
But also, I think part of why it's so successful is the flip side of the same toxic social structure, in that we're communicating with people online more than ever, and yet seem to be lacking more of the social skills.
Yeah.
You know, like you said about people saying the most vile, impersonal things online, because they can be anybody they want behind the keyboard.
Yeah. You speak to people on Twitter, Facebook, even Instagram, whatever it may be, and then you meet them in real life and there's an awkwardness there and you think, oh, you don't have any social skills, and that's fine. But it's odd when you feel as if you've maybe spoken to someone 3 or 4 times and then you're maybe meeting with them to work or you've got to do something, there's an awkwardness there and you go, all right, because you're just not used to having actual social interactions.
Yeah. And it seems like the social bar is getting set lower and lower. Mm-hmm. And people are crying out for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why partly reality TV is what it is. Because people aren't getting the satisfaction and the emotional content in their relationships. Mm-hmm. It's far too surface.
Yeah.
And so they see people dating and fucking and all sorts on TV and they're like, oh, that's real life. That, you know, that's what they're missing out on.
Yeah.
And so, of course, they're going to get addicted to that. In lieu of, you know, maybe pursuing a relationship of their own.
Yeah. Or actually going to a villa and lying in a pool. That's what I keep thinking most. I'm going, we should be on holiday. We should be on holiday now instead of watching this. But yeah, I found it quite fascinating when I would see certain like interactions and I go, it's quite brave putting this out when considering what's previously happened. Or stupid. You know, that they are allowing aspects of their life. Because I have no, like, I know Ian. Ian Stillen, who's the voiceover guy, so I know Ian, so obviously I know the show, but I've never watched it. So there was a bit coming up where, and my girlfriend said to me, right, you'll like this, and they react to tweets from the public. So they have them sitting like in a you know, in a line in a panel, and then two of them read out tweets that the public has put in about the show, and they have to guess who it's about, right? And I thought, this is,
but you see that all the time with celebrities, and I think it's so toxic because that's what it is. They're just like, okay, we're going to find the most hurtful things we can and maybe we'll squeeze a tear out of you.
But it's the fact that we are in a time where people think they are the most liberal or the most open. It's like ancient Rome. Having a celebrity or having someone read a horrible tweet is no different than 1,000 people watching a guy led out as a lion rips them apart. It's ancient Rome, because people don't have these extreme emotions anymore day to day. So they go online, they can look at all the porn they want, they can have access to anything they need, and now you can go and watch celebrities who are historically have been built up as, you know, the best of the best, and you can watch them brought down to a position where you maybe relate to them more because that's how you feel, because you're feeling like shit. But the previous, I mean, you even go like 50, 60 years ago when movie stars, who have probably always been the top of the tree, celebrity-wise, or singers, were the best musicians of their generation, the best singer, the best actors. Whereas now, any fucking dick can get himself famous. You know, if you, there are people who will say, young children will say in school, I want to be an influencer. What the fuck does that mean? What does that mean? But that's,
and what it really means is they want fame.
And it does feel sadly, but that will happen with everything from history and in the future, where we are talking about mental health more often, rightly so, because not only is it a serious thing that affects, I think it affects everyone, but it's an incredibly difficult conversation to have. But there are people who can say, that's the hot topic, man. There will be people at this festival who will be sitting with their agents, you know, and I can only talk from a comedy side because that's what I'm involved in, who will be sitting saying, listen, mental health's a big thing, man. Have you got anything on? Do you want to talk about that? Could you, you know, if we got something to write, something about mental health, would you think we're doing that? Would you think we're doing a podcast about mental health? There will be people who are out there doing that. There'll also be people, you know, who, like yourself, there'll probably be acts offered to you who have got absolutely fuck all to do with mental health.
It's
the new thing to talk about. Do you know what I mean? And then my only hope is that a new issue doesn't come up in the sense of mental health suddenly, it's not the hot topic anymore. Because now that we have started speaking about it, we need to talk more about it. And I think that, especially in Scotland, you know, where, I mean, we only came out recently, like, I think we're number one in Europe now for drug-related deaths. I mean, our alcohol levels are still through the roof, even with minimal pricing. People dying of alcohol overdose is still high.
Yeah.
Oh, I think, and again, it's a sweeping statement, but I think a lot of these things can be treated under mental health.
No, absolutely. Addiction is.
I think when you're unable, like I was for a period of time, unable to speak openly about what you're feeling. If I was maybe in a different situation then, where I didn't have my work to at least have some hope on, I could have easily turned to drink or drugs, you know?
Yeah, and particularly alcohol, I think, is so normalised.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, it's down to your perception. Every person has a different opinion on what constitutes an alcoholic,
mm-hmm.
and it tends to be one glass more than they're having.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah. When my first flatmate and I lived together, I remember him kind of saying to me one day, we're in the living room, and he went, I think I'm an alcoholic. And I went, don't be stupid, man. Like, you drink the same as me. Like, I'm not an alcoholic. We're just young guys, you know, we just drink maybe more than we should. He went, no, man, like, I'm hiding drink in the flat. I went, what? And then when he showed me, he'd been hiding, like, half bottles of whiskey and vodka and stuff. I went, fucking hell, man, like, aye. But then not realising then, like, not having the... maybe not the skills, but not having the knowledge to then take that conversation on. You know, that just became then a joke, you know, of what have you been hiding? Do you know what I mean? Things like that, rather than actually going, yeah. This is my friend who's reaching out. You know, he's actually saying, I need help. But he's structuring a way of going, I think I might be an alcoholic. Whereas now I think hopefully people are more, you know, people would be more aware. I think even in a normal man in the street, if his friend said to him, you know, I'm struggling, I think they would know, right, hold on, this maybe needs help here.
Yeah, and that's true, because there is that hard line
mm-hmm.
that so much is not talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And so people, understandably, don't know what's going to happen if they start a conversation like that.
No.
And even with this podcast, I'm aware that for some of our listeners, that's the appeal, that the kind of conversations I have in the interviews would terrify them to start.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they would not dream of bringing up half the questions I ask.
Yeah.
But actually, the guests answer them. We get to know each other better, and it just normalises what is a normal interaction.
Yeah, but also it's
ultimately because mental illness is a normal part of human life for so many people. Yeah. So it is normal. But the conversations aren't.
No, and also the conversations are different every single time.
Yeah.
There may be someone who is suffering from mental health who can talk about it very easily. But there'll also be people who only want you to listen. You know, so they will talk about it, and I am not looking for you to give me an answer. I'm just wanting to talk to someone. And there will be also people who will say very little because they're hoping that you will speak to them and almost make them feel comforted by it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's no real, that's, again, that's important, there's no right and wrong answer. Because you will have some days where, I certainly found where I only wanted someone to listen to me. You know, and I wasn't looking for them to then give a response or offer advice. I just wanted to get everything out.
Yeah.
And then there was days when, you know, I wanted to just sit and almost feel comforted by someone telling me that, you know, whether it's a therapist or whether it be a doctor or my partner, who would just talk to me to give me some reassurance.
Mm.
Not only is it a hard thing to speak about, it's also a hard thing to then, you know, help deal with. Because even if you are a close friend or a family, you don't know what to do. You don't know whether to do too much, too little. There's then also the fear of, you know, if someone's suicidal, what they do, but you don't then want to smother people. And then, like I said before, when I was... maybe not violent, but when I was angry or I was aggressive, the violence was never towards me. I never self-harmed or anything like that. But again, that could have been the level of anger I had. That could easily have been something that I did. And it's another aspect of mental health that maybe I think personally people don't take that serious. I think maybe people think that's either a cry for help or you're just being daft if you do something like that. But you can think that someone is pushed to the point where they've harmed themselves physically, and yet you still maybe unable to speak about it, you know?
Yeah. You've brought up something there that's an important kind of general rule. I can't think of a situation where someone's been better off not knowing mm-hmm. about the mental illness of a friend, family member, no. colleague, whoever. And so if all you can do is listen,
mm-hmm.
that's such a brilliant start. And as you rightly said, that may be all they even want anyway. They just want somebody to hear them and not disagree and just be patient. And we do live in this internet age. There are upsides.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have a clue about what they're telling you about, then you can sit at a laptop together and you can Google it and you can find a phone number.
Yeah, totally. Someone once spoke to me maybe a year ago, maybe 18 months. In fact, it would have been 18 months ago. And it was to say that their friend had told them that they spoke to them about their mental health, that they'd been depressed and they were, I don't think they were suicidal, but they were certainly feeling as if they didn't want to be in their situation. I think that's how they put it.
Mm-hmm.
And my friend was saying to me, I mean, what the fuck do I do with that? And as if it had been burdened onto him. And that just highlights your point where I'm going, did he ask you to do anything? And he's like, no. I'm going, maybe he just wanted to talk. Like, maybe he just felt closest to you out with the circle that's maybe affecting him. And just by you listening, because I said, did you say anything? I went, no, I said, then I just asked if he wanted another drink. And then we just continued talking about what we were talking about before. And I said, maybe it was as simple as that. Maybe it was as simple as he just wanted to speak to you. And maybe why didn't you just follow up, you know, a call or a text just to say, you know, listen, the other night when you said, you know, I'm here if you want to talk or can I do it? That's as simple as that. I think sometimes people panic as well because they think, right, am I now burdened with this? It's my responsibility. And that just brings it back to what I was saying at the start, where even if you do reach out for help, I think that my GP had never said it to me directly, but from beginning to take medication and then looking at the situation I was in, I realised that, you know, you have to be responsible for your own mental health. Like I said before, you can't just talk to someone, take a tablet and continue to have your life the exact same, because there are reasons why you've become ill. You know, there's reasons why you've become sick. And if you, you know, you would hope that if you had lung cancer and they said it's because you're smoking, you know, you wouldn't continue to smoke. Or if you did and you got sick again, there would be no excuse for it. So if you are in, if you're feeling depressed or you have any mental health issue, I think as well as seeking professional help, there comes a point where you have to sit down and be honest with yourself and think, what in my life is having a real negative impact on me? And if you do want to get better and you do want your health to recover or to a point where you can feel happy or normal, if that's a word,
mm-hmm.
then you have to be very brutal and remove the things from your life. And if anybody comes back at you negatively to say, why have you unfollowed me? Why have you blocked me? Why have you removed me? That simply highlights the fact that those people should not be in your life. And that's one of the hardest things as well that I found, was being honest and saying, right, what is affecting me? And then just trying to remove it.
Right. And particularly with conditions you've experienced like depression, you can so easily feel selfish because you already feel self-indulgent, feeling so sad all the time. Your depression is already telling you you're in the wrong for acknowledging it at all. And then you get it where you realise you need to cut people out of your life. But it's not selfish, because it's not just about you. You're going to be better for everyone else in your life that you keep.
Yep.
It's in everyone's best interest.
Yeah. And it's better to have two or three very good friendships than 100 acquaintances.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
To have, like, real connections with people. You know, and actually start to value the people that are in your life and give them time.
Right. I also love what you said about taking ownership, because ultimately you have to at some point.
Yeah, I mean,
that's why we have to speak up, because it's our responsibility. And you're always going to be the best barometer of your mental health.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to be there day in, day out, knowing how you're feeling and knowing how different variables are affecting that.
Yep.
No amount of medical intervention is ever going to tell you how you're feeling as frequently as your own self does.
Yeah, no. I mean, I'm not saying everyone has to come off social media. We've all done it, where you go on at a certain time and there's pictures going on and you go, God, I need a holiday. I'd love a holiday. We've all done that. And I'm not saying remove that extreme from your life, but I know people still who will specifically follow people on their social media feeds because they hate them, because they want to keep up with what's going on or the shit that they put out. And I'm going, you have no idea the damage that's doing to you. But you have to take that control back and start to think, you know, we are living longer, but life is still short, man. Even if you get in your 80s and 90s, 90 years is not a long time. there's a flat in my street that was built in like 1804 or something. You're going, flat's been there longer than half your family.
Yeah.
It's not a long time, you know, and it's I'm 35 just now. I think if I'm lucky to get into my 80s, I don't want to spend, you know, the first 40 years of being up and down and worrying about mental health, you know, and I don't want the next 40 to be more of the same.
Yeah.
You know, I want to take control of the factors or the external factors that I can control and do the things that you want to do.
Yeah, and that's your legacy for the people around you as well. You know, I think ultimately, if you were to compare them, people are far more affected by your mental health than your physical health.
Mm-hmm.
You know, unless they're, you know, something extreme, like they're literally your carer for a physical ailment.
Mm-hmm.
Day to day, they're more affected by how you are as a person, how well you are inside.
Totally.
And so that's a good place for us, I think, to round up there. Yeah. So if people want to learn more about you, where should they go online?
Website is scottgibsoncomedy.co.uk, and I'm doing the show at the Edinburgh Fringe. It's every day until the 26th of August, 6:15 p.m. for an hour at Gilded Balloon TV.
Which I think is the best venue.
It is the best venue, without a doubt.
All right, thanks so much.
Thanks, man. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.